good afternoon, and thank you for joining us. We're here for the Sunshine Sickle Cell Project, which is a quality improvement initiative. I am Dr. Lynetta Bronte Hall, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Foundation for Sickle Cell Disease Research. And today we will discuss therapies for pediatric patients with sickle cell disease by Dr. Andrew Campbell of Children's National. Dr. Campbell.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bronte Hall, allowing me to speak on this very important initiative. So what we're going to talk about today is updated information on therapies for pediatric patients with sickle cell disease. So as many of us know, sickle cell disease over time has made drastic improvements in terms of survival. And we know that newborn screening started in approximately 1987 and was mandated in all states by 2006. Prior to universal screening, infection was the most common cause of death in children with sickle cell disease. The study of penicillin prophylaxis that happened in the 80s and also the emergence of pneumococcal vaccines have reduced the rate of invasive pneumococcal disease by up to 90%. In fact, greater than 98% of children with sickle cell disease now live to become adults with living with sickle cell disease. Causes of death in children with sickle cell disease then and now. So this is a figure just really looking at what were the causes early on in sickle cell disease history in terms of therapeutics and morbidity and mortality, and versus later on. And you can see these little diamond squares, and the deaths due to acute chest syndrome and multi-organ failure are now the most more common in fatal sepsis. And you can see that 1984, 1988, conjugated influenza type B vaccine here, once that was instituted, right? And also conjugated pneumococcal vaccine. You can see that sepsis here, right, was very common in this time period. But after the 2000s, there's really very little causes of death from infections. But still, in-organ damage from acute chest syndrome, multi-organ failure are more the most common causes of death and also other causes. Okay, the treatment of sickle cell disease in children have evolved. We know there's not been, believe it or not, an FDA-approved drug for sickle cell disease in children for over 100 years. It was not until 2017 that children with sickle cell disease had an FDA-approved drug with L-glutamine, also called Endari, in July 2017, followed by December 2017 that they formally approved it for hydroxyurea in children 2 years and older. So therefore, prior to that, blood transfusions and supportive therapies such as penicillin, folic acid, has been the primary treatment for pediatric sickle cell patients prior to 2017. Now, what's great now is we have two more drugs that were approved for some pediatric patients and adolescent patients with sickle cell disease. That includes in 2019, in November, Voxelotor was approved in adolescents 12 and older. And crizanlizumab was approved for sickle cell patients 16 years and older. So let's talk about a case. So we have this 4-year-old male with sickle cell SS disease who's maintained on hydroxyurea at the maximum dose, 30 milligrams per kilo. Now, the hemoglobin level was 8.0, which is about average, but it's not as high as we want it to be in hydroxyurea. With a fetal hemoglobin of greater than 20%, and that's kind of an invisible marker, if you will, we'd like to shoot for a hemoglobin F of greater than 20% in our patients taking hydroxyurea. So this MCV of 100 is really showing that this patient is compliant. However, the hemoglobin is still just 8. Now, patient experienced increased painful episodes or 3 ER visits in the past 2 months. So what should we do for this child? What can we offer this child? What should we do to optimize his care? What are the treatment options? So when we talk about treatment options, we got to think about sickle cell complications, right? We know that sickle cell disease overall is a multi-organ damaging disease. Essentially, it affects every organ. So we know that it affects the organs in pediatrics versus adults differently. So what do we know? We know right now the acute complications right now, which is in yellow, you can get post-hyphema glaucoma, retinal infarctions. That usually happens in adults, but in adolescence that can happen. Acute chest syndrome, which is sickling in the lungs, pneumonia, acute pain events, septicemia due to damaged spleen. That can happen in children, but also especially in splenectomized adolescent patients, meaning that they got the spleen removed. We know that splenic sequestration, splenic infarcts can happen, of course. The splenic sequestration, the spleen gets trapped with blood. Blood goes into the spleen but doesn't go out. And the sickle cells block the blockage of blood from coming out of the spleen. So it gets enlarged, gets bigger and smaller. We see that a lot in pediatric patients. We're seeing more of it because the use of hydroxyurea, and we don't get that auto infarction that we generally see in SS patients because we're making the sickle cell milder now. So the spleen sequestration can actually go on for beyond age 5 years of age, can go on 7, 8, 9, 10 years of age. Meningitis and stroke, meningitis less likely with the advent of introduction of now meningitis vaccines and penicillin prophylaxis. Stroke, about 10%, 5 to 10% of children will have a stroke, but we screen for stroke risk with transcranial Doppler ultrasound between the ages of 2 and 16 years of age. Liver disease can happen. Gallstones can happen acutely. The sickle cell hepatopathy is basically sickling in the liver. Gallstones are gallstones from increased turnover of red blood cells causing bilirubin gallstones, and that can cause an acute, we call cholecystitis, inflammation of the gallbladder. Papillary necrosis of the kidneys. This is chronic damage of the kidneys, but essentially what can happen is you can have an acute injury to the kidneys and you can get what's called hematuria, where blood goes into the urine. Priapism, acute sickling in the arterial tree of the penis, and that can cause significant pain in the penis, sometimes needing local irrigation, by a urologist. And then bone marrow infarction, so bone, acute pain crisis, but severe bone marrow infarction from severe pain crisis, where you can see infarcts on x-rays, sometimes even MRI. I'm showing that severe infarction can happen in any bones, very commonly in the lung bones. And osteomyelitis, you see most commonly from salmonella, you handling reptiles and around reptilian pets, and or just having it. That is something that we see acutely, and that can cause acute cholecystitis and osteomyelitis, most commonly osteomyelitis. And then I'll just quickly just say chronically, all of these things can also happen. Retinopathy of the eye, pulmonary hypertension can be screened by getting an ultrasound, measuring TR jet velocity. Cardiomegaly can happen over time. The heart can be stressed. Anemia, leukocytosis, high white count, very common in sickle cell disease. Asplenia, we talked about. Complications of pregnancy in women, very well known. That is something that sometimes you need transfusions during pregnancy because you can get more anemic. Skin ulcers can happen in adolescence through adulthood in very anemic sickle cell patients. Chronic pain happens over time in adolescent and young adult patients with repeated bouts of pain crisis. Neurocognitive dysfunction we've seen in pediatric patients from just a chronic anemia and silent infarcts that can happen in about 30% of patients, pediatric patients with sickle cell disease. Proteinuria in the kidneys is very, very common. We see about a third of patients by the age of 20 will have kidney disease, proteinuria, delayed puberty. We see that. And growth, we see 2 years behind their peers. So as patients are going through adolescence, 2 years behind their peers in growth and also in pupil development. So we always tell our families not to worry too much. It will happen. But in the studies that's happened, to large studies in the past, it happens about 1.5 to 2 years later. avascular necrosis, very common, especially in SC disease, where a higher percentage of patients have that. That's associated with dead bone in the femoral heads and the hip bones. Second place is the shoulders and the humeral bones, but can happen anywhere, in the knees, the ankles, anywhere, the back. Anywhere there's bone, you can get AVN. So sickle cell is a multi-organ dysfunction disease. Vaso-occlusive episodes in children. Pain is a hallmark, we know, feature of pediatric patients. It is contributed, it's complex. It can be just, you know, repeated painful episodes, but it can be multidimensional. You can have AVN. You can have acute, you know, osteomyelitis. You can have trauma. It can be visceral somatic, meaning that most of it, you know, visceral can be inside the organs. Like you have splenic pain, you can have GI pain. Neuropathic pain is important because after repeated episodes of pain, you can get neuropathic pain. Pain crisis can start as early as 6 months of age with swelling of the hands and feet, but then evolve into arms, legs, back, pelvis as the child ages. And the vaso-occlusive events or pain crisis can last about 3 to 9 days. And some of those patients will need hospitalizations for that. Pain management in children, generally, we start with acetaminophen, making sure they don't have too much. Try to do more times, no more than 4 times a day. NSAIDs, let's say, you know, ibuprofen, we use that every 6 hours. We try to use those first. If those two medicines fail or they have a severe and we go to opioids, it does work in most patients. But does have a ceiling effect if you keep going up and up and up. The drawbacks is just the side effects, itching, constipation, nausea, vomiting, developing high tolerance over time, increasing the dose over time can lead to intolerance, but also a risk for dependence. So what are the 4 FDA-approved drugs that we have right now, 2021? We know that hydroxyurea is approved right now. What is the mode of action? It increases fetal hemoglobin, decreases inflammation, decreases adhesion. It's FDA approved in adults in 1998, but it took all the way to December 2017 to be approved in children 2 years and older. L-glutamine, Endara is another name, is an antioxidant. Approved in July 2017 in kids 5 years and older. We'll talk about that. Crizanlizumab, anti-adhesion, used primarily to prevent pain. Also, glutamine is used to prevent pain, and crizanlizumab is used to prevent pain. That was approved in adolescents and adults 16 and older in November 2019. Voxelotor increases hemoglobin, improves oxygen delivery to the tissues in children and adults 12 years and older. Consideration. So when we think about therapies, what do we think about? So briefly, we think about considerations, age, route of delivery, oral versus IV, side effect profile. If they have lots of GI side effects, some of these drugs can cause side effects. Prevention, what are the indications? Prevention of in-organ damage. So for example, hydroxyurea, we want to just give them to prevent in-organ damage. Decrease the frequency of symptoms, painful episodes, acute chest. So for painful episodes, we're thinking about not only hydroxyurea, Adafio, and also Endari. Priapism, and also lack of energy. When you like lack of energy, you can think about Voxelotor because that increases the hemoglobin level. The types of therapies, put them in 3 different categories. You have disease-modifying therapies, as we talked about, right? Change the course of the disease without cure. Cure of therapies, for example, bone marrow transplant. There are 2 types. You have sibling match bone marrow transplant. You have hapo transplant, meaning half match from the parents, and the other one is a match unrelated. The most common one we use is the sibling match transplant, has the best outcomes, but we are still studying haplotransplant from a parent because only 15% of patients will have a sibling that match, have a full HLA match for bone marrow transplant. So haplotransplant is now being used more and more under clinical trial settings. Gene therapy, we'll talk about, that is something that right now experimental. About 40 to 45 patients so far have been cured of sickle cell disease right now through 1 clinical trial that we know of at this point. We think about the quality of life. We talk about thinking about therapies. How can it improve their quality of life? you know, side effects, what's the risks and benefits, short-term, long-term. Long-term, you think about developing another chronic disease such as graft versus host disease or worsening another organ system. In going through with a curative therapy, for example, mortality, what's the chance of dying from this therapy? So we know that bone marrow transplant, there is a chance to die, right? Because you can get an overwhelming infection in some transplants that gives you lots of chemo, increased risk of infections, and that can happen. You can have risk of strokes there. Transplant if certain drugs puts you at risk for that. So there's lots of things to think about. Reproductive health. If there's chemotherapy involved in any of these curative therapies, you got to think about your ability to reproduce. Oocyte preservation. So those are all things that we need to think about. So also, in terms of clinical scenarios, low hemoglobin, think about voxelotor, right? If they're in a maximum tolerated dose of hydroxyurea, or erythropoietin, right? We can use that, too, to further increase the hemoglobin level. Persistent pain or hydroxyurea in a maximum tolerated dose. We could give L-glutamine. We could give crizanlizumab also. These clinical trials all had hydroxyurea as part of their patients that were enrolled in the study. They showed to be effective in addition to being hydroxyurea. So those on hydroxyurea, they also benefited of having these drugs added to their regimen to decrease pain or increase hemoglobin. And also someone who has a lot of red blood cell antibodies from repeated blood transfusions, erythropoietin plus hydroxyurea, voxelotor is also optional. I know it's very hard to read. I'm not going to go into detail here. This is a nice summary slide from the New England Journal of Medicine, just showing you all the dose of frequency of all the treatments that we give, especially in pediatrics, pneumococcal vaccines, malaria prophylaxis in sub-Saharan Africa, penicillin, then blood transfusions for acute care, those who have elevated TCD velocities, or stroke prevention, secondary stroke prevention, you see all those. And the duration recommendation, and then hydroxyurea here. So these are kind of the summaries I thought was really nice in 2017, but now we have two new ones. And then how do sickle cell treatments work? Again, this is just a quick schematic diagram, just showing you now this is very complex as we understand sickle cell disease. You see how hydroxyurea works in the white cells, increased fetal hemoglobin, improving nitric oxide delivery, anti-inflammatories, antioxidants, like, for example, Endari, antiplatelet agents. So all throughout the vessel wall, you can see all of these factors, inflammatory factors, adhesion factors, and coagulation factors all play a role, we think, in the genesis of sickling, right? So, okay. And then this is kind of just another schematic diagram just showing on the left how these all play a role at the genetic level, how the sickle cell polymer, there is this loop of how the sickling happens in red blood cell, and then you have hemolysis on the other side, you have sickling, and once you break down hemolysis, that causes systemic vasculopathy, that feeds into inflammation, the inflammation feeds into vasoocclusion, so it's just this really, so when we think about treatments, we're also targeting, these areas of the genotype with transplant, right, hemoglobin S polymerization, with fetal hemoglobin, things like voxelotor, it targets vasoocclusion, and also Adakveo targets vasoocclusion, and also inflammation like L-glutamine. These are the treatment categories, just showing you each one of those. I won't go into detail. Some of these drugs right now in clinical trials, we have like, new ones. But you can see that what he's showing you on the right and the left is basically the different types. So like crizanlizumab is a P-selected inhibitor. L-glutamine increases NDH. And these are just all of the overall treatments categories that we talk about. Blood transfusions, I won't go over into detail, but we have acute goals of transfusions. And then we have chronic goals of transfusions. And we talk about, we talked about this before, but for simple transfusions, splenic sequestration, acute crisis, aplastic crisis, severe acute chest syndrome, perioperative preparation, pregnancy. So you can go on and on. And then prevention for chronic blood transfusions on the right, you know, that's for chronic strokes, elevated transcranial Doppler velocity greater than 200 centimeters per second, multi-organ failure. So that would be something that we also look at. And these are the benefits, a nice summary side of benefits of each treatment. So I'm going to wrap it up in the next couple of minutes because I'm going to talk about this. But really, the hydroxyurea decreases hemolysis, vaso-occlusive acute chest syndrome. L-glutamine does the same with vaso-occlusive acute chest syndrome. The fatigue and quality of life, both for L-glutamine and hydroxyurea, as it relates to voxelotor and crizanlizumab, voxelotor decreases anemia and hemolysis primarily, and then crizanlizumab improves vaso-occlusion primarily. Basically, hydroxyurea is the most effective disease-modifying treatment in adults and children, decreases pain crisis by 50%, hospitalizations by 50%, acute chest syndrome by 50%, decreased mortality in adults. Just showing you the before and after changes in hydroxyurea on the peripheral blood smear. And then this is from the baby hug study in babies, showing you that hydroxyurea significantly lowered pain rates in babies on the average age of 12 months of age versus the placebo group. Pain and dactylitis. Dactylitis is another form of pain crisis in baby, acute chest syndrome, and even hospitalizations. Curative therapies. Right now, there's over 50 clinical trials for allogeneic transplant, autologous transplant, gene therapies. We have a number of gene therapies. Gene therapy and gene editing. There are at least 4 to 5 right now that we have ongoing targeting different. There's lentiviral targeted strategy that's called gene addition to add a new hemoglobin, a fetal hemoglobin inside the gene to make them like a trait patient. And then gene editing where you're changing one of the molecular markers in the red blood cells and we're just telling them to make more fetal hemoglobin. So turning fetal hemoglobin back on, right? So and making substantial amounts of fetal hemoglobin. There's another one called they can do that through CRISPR technology or TALENs, transcription activator like effector nucleases or zinc finger nucleosomes. All of these are new gene editing techniques that we're still learning today or early on in clinical trials. And these are all the disease modifying versus curative therapies like I talked about before, either adding a new gene versus knocking down a gene such as BCL11A that reactivates fetal hemoglobin. Okay, I'll just keep going here. I'm not going to go over this too much. I think we talked about this. In terms of your sibling donor, match unrelated donor, and a mismatch, haploidentical, why we would do each one of those. But you can see a matched sibling donor, the indications are very, very wide. For the unrelated donor or a haploidentical donor, the indications are shorter, are actually more narrow. For the mismatch, for the haploidentical donor, right now they're using silent infarcts and strokes as an indication for that group. Crizanlizumab, the last 3 or 4 slides are just to say that crizanlizumab has anti-stickiness, anti-adhesion, and this slide is showing you that basically to do this, it has to be in generally an infusion center. We give them 2 loading doses, week 0 and week 2, and they give it every month, basically every 4 weeks thereafter. It takes about 6 months to see a response until to say they are a responder or not. So it takes a while to see. It attaches to the vessel wall. We talked about it to P selectin, and that's a sticky protein that prevents causes white cells and platelets to stick to each other. So what crizanlizumab does, it blocks the P-selectin interaction of these cells and the vessel wall. And it showed a significant decrease in pain crisis. So 45% decrease annualized pain crisis rate, 1.63 versus 2.98, which is statistically significant. Voxelotor is our other one I want to talk about, mechanism of action. It binds to the alpha globin chain, causes the chains to change, the hemoglobin to change, increases oxygen affinity, and it allows the sickle cells to actually bind more oxygen and actually deliver more oxygen to the tissues. And it improves that. One of the things we just want to say is giving the kids 12 and older, but we need to reduce the dose from the 1,500 milligrams as its FDA-labeled use, 1,500 milligrams a day, decrease it to 1,000 in a severe liver disease, or taking any strong CYP 3A4 inhibitors, and increase the dose if they're taking CY3A4 inducers. And we talked about why it helps. Okay, and this is just showing you in the study from the HOPE trial, showing that it increased 59% of those patients demonstrated hemoglobin response. And so that was very encouraging versus only 9% of placebo group. And the mean change of hemoglobin was 1.1 from baseline compared to 0.1 versus the placebo group. That's on the right. And the HOPE trial, the updated trial, just showing you out of 274 participants, approximately 65% were receiving hydroxyurea at baseline. They significantly increased hemoglobin levels and reduced markers of hemolysis in those groups. And we're also looking at it in children right now, up to 155 patients with sickle cell disease, 9 months to 17 years of age, assigned to single dose or multiple doses of therapy. So this is something that's ongoing, looking at children. And the last disease-modifying group is L-glutamine, which has reduced the rate of acute complications of sickle cell disease in children 5 years and older. And the L-glutamine uptake in sickle cells is several times greater in the normal red blood than normal red blood cells. You can see that there's a 25% reduction of pain-related crisis versus placebo in those patients taking hydroxyurea over 48-week treatment trial. And just one of the last slides, just showing you basically the bottom line is L-glutamine is giving in packets, 5, 10, and 15 milligram packets based on weight. And you can give 1 to 2 to 3 packets per day to a maximum of 30 milligrams daily. So exciting times are here. Sickle cell is a chronic, lifelong debilitating condition resulting in multi-organ dysfunction and decreased lifespan. Well, we have exciting new therapies are here on the horizon. Thank you so much for listening. Now I'll pass on the baton to Dr. Lynetta Bronte Hall. Thank you.
So you've heard a wonderful presentation, and with everything, you know, we always try to figure out how do we actually implement and monitor standard of care that we do want to implement. So the Sunshine Sickle Cell Project Quality Improvement Initiative will do just that. Our goal is to improve the quality of care for adult and pediatric patients with sickle cell disease in the state of Florida. We want to work with clinicians across Florida who participate in the educational interventions and provide care to patients with sickle cell disease, and I'm your lead investigator. Why should you participate in a sickle cell disease QI project? Well, we know disparities in care exist for patients with sickle cell disease and their families, and ultimately this contributes to suboptimal outcomes. Reimbursement for care have shifted from fee-for-service to value-based models where payments are tied to quality of services delivered. So we've proven, for example, where we've saved a health plan $342 per person per month based on the quality initiatives that we have with that particular plan. Quality improvement projects allow clinicians working within a team to identify an issue and implement interventions that can result in improvements in healthcare quality that result in improved outcomes for patients with sickle cell disease. So what we want to do is identify your gaps in care in your setting, and it may be setting specific. So you may have gaps that are very different from another practice, but our goal is to work within your practice and your resources. So what are some examples of a successful QI project? Well, I've actually participated and created one at Memorial Regional Hospital, where I was for 11 years, and that QI project came along with being certified by the Joint Commission for Sickle Cell Disease. So I know that it can be done, but it will take some resources and some interest from your perspective. So what does it look like in terms of what we measure? So we look at both qualitative and quantitative measures. On the qualitative side, there can be indicators for routine healthcare maintenance, care planning. Some of these are already built into your EHRs, and so you get credit for these, working with your plans already. But we can tweak them a little bit and make some enhancements specifically for sickle cell disease. So management of acute pain crises, for example. How satisfied are the patients with care? Because we know that they do have some issues with some of the providers, and they do make complaints a lot to administrators. And so some of you may have been on the opposite end of that, where you've received some of those complaints. So we want to be proactive and actually understand if you are receiving complaints, how we can make that better for you as well. And then on the quantitative side, what about the healthcare use? Are the patients going to the ED a lot? Are they having long lengths of stay? What about the ICU admissions? So we'll work with you so that we can create a tool to actually monitor some of these indicators. But we will increase the care planning and management of your patients. And again, we'll do that within a team. We'll increase the appropriate assessment, treatment, and management of sickle cell disease using standard practice guidelines from the National Institutes of Health and also the American Society of Hematology. And we'll increase patient and family education and shared decision-making, which is so important for this patient population, and for any patient population, is really to include patient and families in the decision-making process. And overall, these initiatives will lead to a reduction in ED visits and acute vaso-occlusive crises. We'll identify in six steps, well, by asking these six pertinent questions. What is the problem? What is causing the problem? What is the goal? What steps will we take to reach the goal? And how will we know the staff are following the plan? And how will we know the plan is working? And yes, you may have an office manager who kind of does, overall management and may be addressing some of these, but there's a way that we can go in and provide some additional resources so that at the end of the day, we'll have some plans. An immediate action plan. We have a plan to get data, a plan to act, and then also a plan to validate. So it's a very strategic process. And these personal plans of action is where you'll get an opportunity to write down five things that you can do to improve healthcare quality for your patients with sickle cell disease. And of those five that you write down, we'll select the top three, because we don't want you to feel overwhelmed. And typically about three items is what we can manage in terms of implementing, monitoring, validating, and making any tweaks that we need to make. Here's an example of a QI monitoring tool using SharePoint. This is with one of my health plans, community care plan. They actually created the SharePoint drive for us. And so we go into the system where we're able to get the patient's information, what day the case management contacted the patient. So we actually know who the case manager is, and then we're able to interact with that case manager either through secured emails, but we get a lot of information from the case managers and work very closely with them because they do have a population of patients that they follow. We also track biomarkers on our patients, and we're very excited about this. We work with an outside lab called Functional Fluidics, and what these biomarkers assess, Dr. Campbell spoke about the inflammatory biomarkers, VCAM and P-selectin, and also the red blood cell fragility and the medications that can target these biomarkers. So crizolizumab, for example, targets the VCAM and the P-selectin, and the voxelotor targets the red blood cell membrane fragility. So we actually have about 1,500 samples that we have sent to Functional Fluidics, and what we're now starting to receive back is how much pain are the patients actually in, because that's always the question at the end of the day. Is this subjective score really valid? So the points that you see that are in the red zone, so this is a critical lab, just as you would receive from Quest or LabCorp, and they call you up and say, you know, doc, I got a critical lab that I need to report. What we're seeing is that the patients are always in a critical zone in terms of their inflammatory response to sickle cell. And, you know, this is pretty amazing that we now have a way to validate that pain score. And I can tell you that the patients who come in for pain, they all look like this, versus the ones that we never see for pain, they have a profile that's more normal. You don't see the increase in the inflammatory markers. So we're so excited to be able to bring you this data. And Dr. Campbell is also sharing data from his institution. And so we know that across all academic or in the community, these data are valid. Again, this is another patient, and you can see they're in the red zone. So your patients are in the pain that they're telling you they're in, and we're here to help you get them hopefully assessed for these new medications and get them in a better state of health. This is what a report can look like. So again, working with Community Care Plan, I get this information by email, and then I'm able to see when the patient is due for, you know, X, Y, or Z. And so we'll be able to provide a similar report for you. The example methodology, we will create and implement a protocol for pain management in the ED, for example. If you're attached to an institution where you constantly have patients that are going back and forth from the ED, and these are patients that you monitor. So primary care doctors, for example, will have patients who they may not see very frequently, but they get reports that the patient is going back and forth to the ED. That's the patient we want to help manage with you, so that you can improve those metrics with that plan that you're enrolled in. Things that will be able to help you track are mean time for triage to first analgesic dose, for example, if it's an ED protocol. So it just depends on the protocol and depends on the location. So what are the next steps and how do you participate? Well, about 3 months following the conclusion of all educational interventions, there will be interviews about 60 to 90 minutes. I'll be reaching out to the stakeholders, the patients, the providers, people at the clinic level, and we'll use a semi-structured interview guide to get your understanding of QI and then also what gaps you've identified in your organization. So in addition to the quantitative data that we'll be collecting, there'll also be some chart reviews and pulling out some of those ICD codes as well. We'll collect the data, analyze it concurrently, again, using both quantitative and qualitative approach. And we hope to include 50 to 100 clinicians. You'll have a dashboard where you'll be able to see how your patient population is doing. And you'll be able to compare to other clinicians that are participating. Although the patient information will be blinded, you'll be able to see your patient information, but not the other clinicians' information. Okay.